This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Take a deep breath. Half the oxygen you just breathed in came from the ocean. But there are portions of the ocean where there's almost no oxygen. And those areas are actually expanding. They're often called dead zones, but in fact, there is life in some low oxygen areas. What kind of life and how it persists is the focus of Max Saito's research. Max Saito is associate scientist with tenure in the Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry Department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He was the chief scientist on a recent cruise to the tropical Pacific. Matt, good to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here.
And Michelle Schwengel-Regala is a fiber artist who has used her knit and crocheted creations to educate audiences about coral reefs and the deep ocean. She joined that same cruise, and she repeatedly yarn-bombed the research vessel Falkor. She joins us now from a studio at Hawaii Public Radio. Michelle, welcome to Living Lab.
Aloha, Heather. Hi, Mac.
Hello.
Michelle, you actually have an undergraduate degree in entomology and wildlife ecology. How did you get from that to being a knit and crochet artist? What happened in between?
Right. That's a pretty crazy trajectory, isn't it? But I wouldn't have wanted it any other way, really. When I was going into college, I was enjoying making art in one form or another. I can remember seeing some brochures that my high school art teacher had about Parsons School of Design in New York. And there was a part of me that aspired to go to art school someday. But in the meantime, I decided to focus on science. And that was my real passion as when I was a child. And then it evolved into this study of conservation biology and taxonomy. I studied beetles. I became an entomology major, and I loved the beetles. And while I was in one of my classes, I was doing little drawings on my notebook margin, and that helped me realize what the anatomical structures were that I was trying to learn. And one of my professors saw that work, and he said, "Hey, you're an artist? Oh, great! Would you like to be a scientific illustrator in my lab?" And it hadn't occurred to me that being an artist, a technical artist in this capacity, could be a career unto itself. I always enjoyed field guides and illustrated manuscripts, but it hadn't occurred to me to put it together and pursue it professionally. So this illustration job became my job that put me through college, and then it was something that I pursued after a bit of time studying more taxonomy in grad school. And working at museums, working with scientists as a freelancer, a staff illustrator, was really a dream job of mine, to be able to participate in the science research process and to be able to communicate these ideas to the public through not only the scientists' words, but also the images that I would create in tandem was so fantastic. So I enjoyed contributing to that field for many years. I moved to Hawaii 10 years ago and didn't pursue that type of work quite so much for the beginning of that time, and instead did more fine art work like watercolor paintings and still using natural history as my inspiration. Then when I became a parent, I thought, what medium can I work in that will still allow me to be home with my child for this time and yet express my creativity? And it occurred to me that fiber would be a great medium. And then that's when I started making more natural history subjects in sculptural form, in three dimensions. And so I'm really glad that there was something that popped up that allowed me to keep working, even through that time when I was a stay-at-home mom. And indeed, that was one of my more productive times. I wouldn't have expected it to be that way, that it turned out that way.
I'm really impressed that you managed to knit or crochet anything that complex during your child's early years, because as a mom who used to do a lot of knitting and crocheting, I've resigned myself to stocking stitch for the foreseeable future because I can't keep track of any more complex patterns. So I'm very impressed with your productivity.
Thanks. I definitely didn't try to follow any patterns at that time. It was more of a working on the fly, kind of make it up as I go along process. So file that away for yourself. You might find enjoyment in that too.
So tell me a little bit about some of the large scale projects that you have done. You mentioned these three dimensional sculptural. Is it knit or crochet or a bit of both? You have one project, Hook the Reef, and another, Hook the Deep.
The project that was my first fiber art project was the one you mentioned, Hook the Reef. And that's the short title for the longer version, the Hawaii Hyperbolic Crochet Coral Reef Project. And this was something that I had learned about years prior when I lived in Los Angeles. There's an organization called the Institute for Figuring, and it's run by a pair of sisters, twin sisters from Australia. One's a science writer and with an emphasis in math and physics, and the other is an art writer, a creative writer. And the two of them have this affinity for the Australian Great Barrier Reef ecosystem and wanted to develop something that would be a jumping off point for education about that crisis, you know, that ecosystem that's in crisis, and engage people through making. And that reef project is a community art project. And these Australian sisters started the project in one community, and then it almost became a franchise whereby other interested people in other cities around the world could develop the same concept in their own community. And when I was in Hawaii as a new mom, I was thinking, what can I do? And it occurred to me that I could use this model here in Hawaii to raise awareness about the ecosystem around the Hawaiian archipelago. And I invited people from around the world to knit or crochet items that were inspired by actual species we have here in this realm. I didn't require that people make things, you know, to scale or with any precision. It is very much up to their own level of expertise or interest and abilities. And so people might be inspired by the color of some cleaner wrasse, you know, that has purple and yellow, or they could be inspired to make something as elaborate as a slipper lobster. And so this project gathered more than 400 pieces from so many people, and then we put it all together as an exhibit. And that was a really new method of working for me. I hadn't done collaborative works like that in the past, other than my work as a science illustrator with scientists. So this was a new development for me, and I've enjoyed taking that into other projects. Do I tell my secrets here? Yes, okay.
Well, which I've secrets also would those be?
another large-scale fiber project that I've worked on has been with a yarn bombing crew called The Fuzz.
And okay, so first you have to define this term. What is yarn bombing?
Oh, sure. Yarn bombing is a type of street art. It's a type of graffiti that, instead of using paint, makes textiles. It could be knit fabric, crocheted fabric, and then instead of putting up paint on a surface in an urban setting, we put up these textiles that we've made. And it's a surface that it's a material that doesn't alter permanently the surface it goes on. Instead, it's a temporary sort of decoration, and if someone doesn't like it, they can take a pair of scissors and take it off. It's not the kind of potentially harmful affixing that painters often are dealing with.
We've had a project, I guess, might fall into that category, although I haven't heard it called yarn bombing, here on the Cape, with knit and crocheted sweaters or scarves for trees, where in one area, just overnight, a whole bunch of trees were suddenly wrapped in these beautiful, colorful knit, as I said, sweaters, scarves, whatever you want to call them, knit collars for trees in the forest.
Mm-hmm. That's how we roll. We work in stealth. We make our plans, and then all of a sudden, poof, there it is.
It was pretty fun being on the ship and seeing, you know, coming around a corner and suddenly seeing some pole or something that normally was sort of an industrial paint color be all bright and colorful and covered with yarn.
Well, so, Mac, have you ever been on board a ship with an artist before? What was that experience like?
No, this is my first time. And from what I understand, this is actually the second time the Schmidt ship has had an artist on board. So it was great.
In case you're just joining us, my guests are Michelle Schwengel-Regala and Max Saito. They recently returned from a research cruise on which one was an artist in residence and one was the chief scientist. Mac, you were the chief scientist. The title, if you can call it that, for this cruise was Life Without Oxygen in the Tropical Pacific. Often these areas of the ocean that have little or no oxygen are called dead zones. Clearly, they're not dead in all cases. What kind of life actually does manage to live there?
Right. So that's a great question. Dead zones usually are referring to coastal areas that are experiencing a lot of local pollution, nitrogen and fertilizer type pollution that's causing blooms of algae that then can sink. And as those sink and decay, they consume a lot of oxygen and then cause these low oxygen conditions and dead zones that make it difficult for fish and other animals to live. But what people don't know or recognize quite as much is that there are actually large regions of the oceans that are low in oxygen that extend usually from the eastern sides of the ocean basins in both the Pacific and the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean, way across, you know, halfway across the basins or farther. And these regions are called oxygen minimum zones, and they're naturally occurring, but there's accumulating evidence that they are actually getting larger because of climate change effects. In particular, the warming of the oceans decreases the solubility and slows down the circulation of the upper ocean with the deeper oceans or the intermediate depths of the oceans, and that prevents oxygen from being renewed down at those depths.
So what are the natural processes? Is it just that the water is too warm to hold that much oxygen, or are there other natural causes for these low oxygen areas?
Yeah, they're often called shadow zones because they're sort of at the corners of the gyre circulation systems, and so those regions don't have a robust intermediate circulation process anyway, and so the combination of this lessened circulation and then high productivity that's often associated with these environments, like the Peru upwelling and the California upwelling, have very high productivity, can also cause these significant productivity events, phytoplankton blooms and associated higher trophic levels that then can decrease the oxygen beneath them.
I mean, that seems like a complete paradox that you've got these areas that are so productive, so rich in plankton life, that they end up kind of burning themselves out and turning into a low oxygen dead zone.
I think the important thing is to remember there's some vertical separation. You know, the phytoplankton live in the upper 100 or 150 meters of the ocean, and that those layers can exchange gases with the atmosphere quite readily. But these oxygen minimum zones are sit beneath that in what's called the twilight zone, where, you know, between 150 and 1,000 meters, and those layers are usually, you know, very dark and less prone to exchange with the atmosphere.
And I've heard that these low oxygen zones are expanding. Is that because of natural processes or man-made processes?
Right. You know, I think the jury's out, but evidence is accumulating that they are that the cause is climate change related effects. You know, the oceans absorb a tremendous amount of heat associated with the warming of the Earth, and in doing so, that creates a barrier towards circulation with these intermediate depths.
Michelle, you, as you said, had already done projects on coral reefs, on other deeper parts of the ocean. How familiar were you with the science that Mac is talking about here before you went out on the cruise?
Mm-hmm. When I was in college, I took basic chemistry and physics, and all of that was floating around in my mind while we were beginning to discuss these things. But really, this was a whole new way for me to look at this type of oceanography. It was not familiar to me at all, but I love that I had this opportunity to do this on-the-job training of sorts.
Well, did you get up to speed? Was that, you know, reading beforehand, or was it talking to scientists on board the ship?
I wish I could have had more time to read more before boarding the ship, but that turnaround time was so fast. It was barely enough time for me to pack and arrange my life so that it could continue at home while I was away for 4 weeks. Luckily, the scientists, Mac and everyone, were so open to discussing with me any questions I had about what was going on. I sat in on the science meetings during all of the days on board, to the point that I was always taking in information about what was going on, what the science mission was about, and how these sampling sessions would take place, and what their purpose was. So this is a really fantastic immersive experience. Even though I wasn't hands-on, in that I wasn't necessarily working with the equipment, I was seeing the data roll in at the same time that the scientists were, and so I was you know, step by step getting a handle on what was going on. Now that I am home, I do intend to read more papers about this branch of science and continue to learn more so I can inform the future artwork that I make related to the trip.
I wonder, though, if perhaps not having such a deep knowledge of the science presents its own advantages in a way, that your fresh eyes to interpret this for an audience for your artwork who will perhaps have absolutely no exposure to the science when they first see your works of art.
Yes, I like that way of seeing the situation, Heather. I do agree, though. I think it is important to view this from different vantage points and different perspectives. So I in that regard, it was very well planned.
That's Michelle Schwengel-Regala. She was the artist at sea on a recent research cruise to the tropical Pacific investigating low oxygen areas. The chief scientist on that cruise was Max Saito, and he's here in the studio with me. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with oceanographer Max Saito and artist Michelle Schwengel-Regala about their recent expedition to the tropical Pacific Ocean to understand how life persists in low oxygen zones and then interpret that science through yarn art. Mac, you were explaining kind of the basics of the plankton blooms and how that then results in these low oxygen areas in the ocean underneath them. What were the questions that you were really trying to answer on this cruise specifically about those areas?
Right. So we were really interested in the microbial populations that live in these oxygen minimum zones between 150 and 800 meters down and what kinds of chemical reactions that they were doing. And our way of investigating that is we were adapting, have been adapting some biomedical technology known as proteomics, which is the ability to study proteins in life in a very high throughput capacity. It's analogous to genomics, but instead of studying genes, you're studying proteins.
And what can you read, I guess, essentially? What can you learn from seeing what proteins are there?
Yeah, so proteins are really fantastic to look at. The reason being that unlike genes, which tell you the potential for what an organism can do, the proteins, which are basically the translated genes, tell you what an organism is doing. And in this case, you can see what reactions they're carrying out because the enzymes that they use to facilitate the reactions are themselves proteins.
So you can actually get a sense. Are you looking at the individual cells and individual types of plankton, or are you just looking at this as one big kind of biochemical soup? What are the enzymes and the reactions that are going on down there?
It's both, really. That's one of the challenges of applying this medical technology to the oceans. Is, you know, it's literally the exact same technology that's used to diagnose cancer. But for our medical colleagues, it's actually arguably an easier problem because they are just measuring human or just measuring yeast or whatever their organism is. But in the oceans, you take a water sample and it's going to have 1,000 organisms or more mixed together, and we can't separate them very easily. And so we have to, you know, we basically get a puzzle of the constituents and have to piece back who is there and what they're doing from that.
How fundamentally different, or do we even know yet, is life in these low oxygen zones from life in other parts of the ocean?
You know, it's really different. The reason why chemically these regions are one of the most interesting regions to study in the oceans is that when you start reducing the amount of oxygen present, organisms adapt or have different strategies to make their generate their energy and live their lives. In particular, they start breathing nitrogen, nitrate, instead of oxygen. And that then cascades through a bunch of reactions that control and influence the amount of nitrogen in the oceans.
Can understanding the life that exists in these natural low oxygen zones translate to understanding what might happen in the areas where, you know, closer to shore? This is very familiar here on the Cape, right? That we get nutrient pollution that goes into coastal waters. You get an algal bloom, you get a fish kill, you basically get a low oxygen zone temporarily. Can what you're learning help us deal with those events in any way?
Yeah, very much so. We're really trying to develop a new method to help diagnose ocean ecosystems and their microbial populations and the functions that they carry out. And so, you know, the beauty of the method is we can go in there, we can take a suite of water samples and then analyze them, and we can see, you know, we can see everything that the ecosystem is really doing on that microbial scale. So we can see what are the major enzymes and what the reactions they're doing. And so with that kind of tool, we should be able to go out to any region of the ocean and then do this kind of survey approach and understand what the system is doing and how it's responding to environmental stressors.
Michelle, as all this cutting-edge research is happening on the boat, what was your goal as the artist at sea with all of these scientists?
It was quite a task, trying to understand things on such a minute scale, you know, on a molecular scale, looking at metal, looking at these archaea, microbiology, you know, all of these small scale organisms and materials were so distant from my art life prior to this experience. And so trying to bring those elements into something that I would put together with my hands. You know, that was such a challenge. It's something I'm still processing. It's certainly going to take me a while to see the thread between the disparate projects that I developed while I was on board, but obviously they're all connected because they all happen in the same place. They're all generated by the same experience. But it is quite a task for me, you know, someone who had otherwise looked at the world on a macrobiological scale, looking at organisms, you know, like these deep sea fish that are the deepest living vertebrate organisms. You know, that I can make without a problem. But working with molecules, working with proteins, you know, this was a fantastic challenge for me to undertake, and I'm so thankful for the experience. I was glad to at least be able to bring materials that related to the concept that Mac works with. You know, I brought silk yarn and I brought wool yarn and I even collected.
And how do those relate to what mm-hmm. Mac is talking about in terms of microbial life and the proteins used to survive without oxygen?
Right. Those yarns are natural fibers and they're made of protein. They're made of the same types of molecules, the materials that Mac was looking at through the water samples. So this I appreciated a lot. And I was also thinking about the metal in terms of iron. I was wondering about if I could use iron as a mordant to be able to change the dye process. I was thinking of dyeing some of these natural fibers while I was on board. But then it also occurred to me that, no, I don't necessarily want to bring more iron into the laboratory setting where these guys are trying to eliminate the iron from their bubble lab. Right. So that's another example of the way what I've learned on the ship will find its way into my art that I make from here on out. It was such a generative experience. It was incredible. So I, even while Mac was speaking about the shadow zones, I was taking notes right here, adding this to the list of jumping off points that I'm quite certain that I'll explore
down
the road.
That was one of the appeals of having Michelle on the cruise too, is that, you know, we know what we study is visually difficult for the general public to grasp and understand, but we also know it's very important for people to understand what we call biogeochemistry, because it's sort of essential to understanding climate change. And so, you know, getting the opportunity to find other venues and other ways to collaborate and try and bring this kind of knowledge to the public is really exciting and interesting.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with oceanographer Mac Saito and artist Michelle Schwengel-Regala. Michelle, I want to hear more about the projects you actually did while you were on the ship, your yarn bombing projects. How many of those were planned ahead of time, and how many of those were just a spontaneously inspired idea?
Right. I tried in my application for this Artist at Sea program to line up a few ideas that I might be able to implement if I were chosen for the voyage. And luckily, I think there were four projects that I proposed that ended up manifesting on the ship. And so I was happy that there was that continuity between my initial ideas and then whether or not they could happen in that real space. One project that I worked on was to knit these square panels in knitting parlance. You'd know this as a swatch. I knitted swatches of wool yarn and added a gradient of blue silk fibers through the length of it to give the idea of depth. And then on top of that surface, I used the data that we saw coming in from the equipment that the scientists were sending down on the wire. The information coming in would give a glimpse of the status with these variables about what that section of the ocean had to offer. So it told us how much oxygen there was at different depths. It told us the amount of fluorescence that relates to the amount of phytoplankton along these different depths and the temperature. You know, there were all these data points that were informing the scientists about the water column in this space. And then once the equipment got to a certain depth, then they could raise the equipment and then take their samples along the way back up. And seeing those numbers and those levels on the monitors in real time was really exciting to me. And that became one of the projects that I worked up. So I would embroider those different levels on this swatch. And I was making one for each of the sampling stations that we went to along the journey.
That sounds like a really beautiful version of the graphs that Mac, you and your colleagues would probably be making to represent that same data. And you mentioned the value of having Michelle there to help you translate this science for the public. But I wonder if there's a value for you as a scientist as well to see your data in this really different way.
It was really cool to see these swatches and see that, you know, they were yarn graphs. It was really cool. And you know, and Michelle did a great job of capturing, you know, interesting features that we saw. We saw this double chlorophyll max that we were calling the unicorn profile. And there it was in yarn on the wall. And that was really, really fun to look at and then start thinking about what that really meant.
I was glad to be able to bring these images to light because, in a way, these are sets of information that the public really wouldn't see. It wouldn't be, or these types of data wouldn't necessarily be published as a graph in a journal article because it's just so fundamental. And these were really the landmarks that the scientists used to determine where they would sample their water. And from there, then they would get different information from the water once they had it in their lab to study. So this is kind of that invisible preparatory work that goes on during during field work. And part of me wanted to bring this to light because it's more tangible in a way. I mean, these are the physical and chemical properties of the ocean right here. And then later on, the scientists are going to analyze other things about the water samples. And in a way, those other things are maybe more abstract. So these variables like oxygen and temperature and salinity, you know, these are things I think people can relate to about the ocean, even if it's not the more processed and analyzed components that the scientists are going to work on and talk about later on. I liked being able to document these moments along the way.
Well, and we're constantly being told the ocean is not the same everywhere, and yet most of the water to our eyes looks about the same. And so to be able to visually show how different it is, even mm-hmm. in one place, just going up and down in depth, seems really important.
And I learned that this was not necessarily the first time these groups of scientists had sampled water from these areas. And I like that there's a repeat action in place here, that this was another sample that over time can tell us more about the story that the ocean is telling us, and the changes that are going on between different periods of time.
Now, one of the other projects you did, and you posted this on Facebook, and I couldn't resist playing with it, was actually a QR code. You knit a QR code, you know, those square digital codes. I did eventually manage to get my phone to scan the QR code. So it worked. It was a functional QR code. And you had a number of other projects, one that involved Morse code. What was the significance of those codes? Why were you, you know, not only trying to speak through yarn, but trying to speak in code through yarn?
I'm really glad that crochet QR code worked for you. I liked that this was a project that I could work on early on in my time on board. You know, I checked in with the Schmidt Ocean Institute to find out what was a good URL that I should use as the destination that the QR code scan would take you to. And I was able to work that up while my eyes were still being affected by the anti-nausea medicine that I was on. It was a crazy balance that I had to strike those first few days, but I wanted
to remain
productive.
That doesn't sound pleasant. I mean, why was your eyesight affected?
You know, that was something I couldn't have anticipated, but apparently having blurred vision is one of the side effects of this medicine, this scopolamine patch that I put behind my ear. I wasn't the only person on board that used this to remain healthy and productive during the time on board, but I think I was the only person that had that particular side effect.
You know, people imagine a cruise across the equator and you think it's going to be all beautiful weather, and this one we had some significant winds and sea state, and it was really hot too. So I was glad to get back to the cold of New England when we were done.
Not something you hear every day in February in New England. Michelle, was this your first time being at sea this far from land, at least?
It was by far, yes, yes. You know, I had grown up in the Midwest, and I enjoyed canoeing and boating, and then upon moving to Hawaii, I spent more time in the water surfing and kayaking. But even a time on a ferry, a car ferry in the Philippines, or on a cruise ship in Baja California, you know, this is so different from any of those experiences.
What is it like psychologically to be out there for the first time?
Mm-hmm. I think that the fact that I began my voyage in Hawaii, this place that is my home now, really changed my sense of what it was to be out there, because of the history of the way Hawaii became populated by people, because of the Polynesian voyaging traditions. That really, really changed my perspective about what it was to be out in the open ocean, to be in the middle of Polynesia, to be in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It was so awe-inspiring. It was so humbling. It was incredible, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around that. Because there's the current Hokulea voyage going around the world and using only the traditional voyaging canoe design for their vessel and using only stars for their navigation sources. You know, there are parallels between these two experiences, and yet they're so vastly different. You know, the ability for us to communicate with the rest of the world was so easy, but you know, trying to consider approaching the Hawaiian Islands with just the stars as your guide, or birds and currents. Okay, there are other biological instructions that can be read, but you know, the comparisons were vast for me, and I'm so glad that I had the chance to see it through these eyes and through this perspective.
Mac, you're nodding along. You've got to be incredibly busy while you're out on one of these research cruises. Do you get a chance to stop and think about where you are, enjoy the beauty of it, and just contemplate being in the middle of the ocean?
Yeah, you know, I always try to make some time for that, because it's really, it just changes the way you think about the world when you are at sea for weeks at a time and you don't see land and you just see water to the horizon in every direction. You really, you know, in a way that you can't really get a sense for when you're on land, you can really feel how big the oceans are and what a dominant part of the planet they are.
Is that an experience that you wish more people could have?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, we're in our daily lives, we're all so busy and doing our own routines and stuff like that. But when you get out there and your communication is much more difficult with the rest of the world, and you can really slow down and see the natural beauty and the power of the oceans, it's really a different perspective it gives you on the planet.
That's Mac Saito. He's an oceanographer at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Also with us is Michelle Schwengel-Regala, a fiber artist. I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking this hour with oceanographer Mac Saito and artist Michelle Schwengel-Regala about a recent expedition to the tropical Pacific to try to understand how life persists in areas where there's almost no oxygen, and then, on Michelle's part, to interpret that science through yarn art. Mac, how much of the research that you're doing actually happens aboard the ship? How much do you kind of recreate a really, you know, as you said, almost like a biomedical lab on the ship, or are you really just out there gathering water and samples that you'll work with later?
You know, a lot of it we bring back. Our strategy is that the oceans are so big that the time on the ship is most valuable. The best use of the time on the ship is to acquire as many samples as we can, and that way we can see as much of the ocean as we can. And so we have a very aggressive and sort of round the clock sampling program where we're out there filtering water and deploying sampling devices. And you know, I think we calculated we filtered over 85,000 liters of water through our in situ McLean pumps out there. And that was a new record for us by far. But all those samples we put into coolers and fly back with them as luggage because they're too valuable to send by FedEx. That always makes for an interesting scenario at the airport. but then part of the reason why we like to do them back in the lab is because then our machines are so valuable, we don't really want to ship them halfway across the world. And then we can really optimize for high throughput sample extraction and analysis. And actually, it was funny when you're talking about the QR codes. One of the things on this cruise we really adopted was moving to barcoding and QR codes. And so it was fun to see Michelle knitting them while we were, you know, deploying them for the first time, trying to keep track of our thousands of samples with little barcodes as well.
I can imagine in the long run with thousands of samples, QR codes and digital codes could be really helpful. But in the moment, when you're out there on a ship, that's got to be almost impossible. You can't recognize it with the human eye. Oh, that's the sample from yesterday that needs to go here. How do you manage that?
Well, luckily you can have little text strings that go along the bottom of them. So, you know, you can read part of it, but then it's scannable as well. And so we'll be able to sort of, you know, process and move samples through archives and storage capacities that way.
Michelle, Mac mentioned the round the clock schedule that the science staff was on, but you're a one woman crew. What kind of schedule did you adopt?
This was not so different from my regular life in a way. while we had the housekeeping staff, you know, I didn't have to cook, I didn't have to do my laundry, I didn't have to take my son to school. I still kept late hours. I would often stay up past midnight working on projects. And it seemed like at 5:30 in the morning, that was a time when strange motions on the ship might happen. And so I often woke up at that time. But that also meant that I often got to see the sunrise, and I was up for an early day, and I could get back to work. It was okay that I was going through another period of low sleep for the sake of productivity. I wanted to savor every moment that I was on the ship. And so in that way, I was glad that I was working hard and working pretty long hours. But I slept really well. There's something about that rocking motion of the ship that was almost like being, you know, in a, cradled and supported and lulled to sleep. So I never had a problem falling asleep and felt really comfortable in that setting.
Now, you wrote in one of your blog posts on the Schmidt Ocean Institute website that you were examining the ship's waste stream for possible materials for your projects. What did you find?
I want to give a shout out to my husband to to reference the fact that he has often given me some warnings about approaches like this. he doesn't want me to get too crazy with this stuff. And, you know, like asking people for their hair, come on, this is weird. But at the same time, the hair from our heads is another protein material. And you know, if I had run out of yarn, then what would I use to keep working while I was at sea? I don't know. I wanted to see what alternative materials I could come up with that were right there on board. I know a number of artists who work with marine debris, things that are found out in the ocean, things that aren't necessarily supposed to be there. And that was a question I had before I was on board. I wondered, would we see some of these ghost nets that are becoming a more familiar part of the ocean landscape? Would there be much debris that we'd see in the water? And I thought, you know, can we use a hook and grab some of these things, bring it on board when we're at station? You know, it turns out we didn't see much material like that at all. And while it doesn't mean that the ocean isn't filled with materials like plastics that shouldn't be there, it just meant that that wasn't a material resource that I could count on. So I looked to the hair from the people. Thank you very much.
And Mac, did your hair end up in any projects?
I don't know about that, but I certainly contributed to the supply.
Thank you very much. Because our trip was cut short by 1 week, this was one of the projects that I didn't end up getting around to on board, but I still have these supplies, and so we'll see what comes of them. Another material that I gathered was the lint that came from the laundry room on board. I went to the dryers, and then I scraped up that lint that was on that lint trap. And some of these are from, you know, it's a byproduct of using fiber. I like that it's residual fibers that are coming off your clothes that are made of textiles. So I'm not yet certain how I'll use that material, but I'm keeping that as another resource to include in future projects related to the experience.
Was there any waste or leftover from the science operations that could be used in any way?
Oh, I was given some copper tubing that one of the graduate students was using to connect her gas tanks to her equipment. And that is a material that I'm glad that she had the presence of mind to offer to me. I'm quite certain that I'll use that in some project. But Mac, please, I know you know more about this stuff.
Well, I was thinking about the keratin of the hair. You know, that's something when we do our protein analysis, we usually see keratin in the samples, which is usually from, you know, a contaminant from a person who was preparing the sample or someone's sweater or something like that. So there's a little bit of overlap there too, keratin being a protein.
Now, Michelle mentioned that the cruise was actually cut a week short. The ship had some mechanical issues. I trust everyone was safe the whole time, but you did have to come in a week early. And I wonder what the repercussions for the science are. When you're out on this cruise, you have 4 weeks planned, jam-packed. These are the samples we need from these places. When you have to come in a week early, is that money, time, effort that's completely lost, or is there ever a way to make that up?
Yeah, so one of the generators went down on the ship, and the ship has four generators. So, and you know, the ship is the generators on the ship are roughly 30 years old. So, you know, it was an unexpected and unavoidable, but unfortunate circumstance. So, you know, we understood that, and the crew was fantastic in trying to do everything they could to prolong the cruise. But at the end, the captain had to make a safety call and say, you know, I don't think we're safe out here without the complete supply of power that we need. In case something else goes wrong. And, you know, we understood that when you're literally a week away from land in any direction, you know, you're out there surviving on your own capabilities, and so we had to go in for safety reasons, mostly to repair that engine. And but it's true, you know, we lost a week of our ship time, our research time. Fortunately for us, we had asked for enough time that we got a lot done already. We had already had 21 days or so of working really hard and getting a lot of great samples. And because we had pushed ourselves to get those samples, we actually have a really good inventory of samples. But it's true, at this point, you know, will we be able to go back out there? You know, it'll cost more money to send all the gear and people out there again in the future. And, you know, reserving ship time and requesting ship time is a 1 to 2 to 3 year process through the grant cycles. So it's hard to get out on the oceans, and so the time out there is really precious.
The ship you were on is called the RV Falkor, and it's, as I think we've mentioned, owned by the Schmidt Ocean Institute, Eric and Wendy Schmidt of Google. So it's not part of the government-run fleet of research vessels that most scientists are going out on. How different an experience is it to be out on a privately owned research vessel?
Yeah, that was very interesting. You know, in some ways, it's very similar. You know, it was a research vessel outfitted with a lot of the standard equipment and sort of crew roles that we're used to. But then in other ways, it was different. You know, they operate with largely an international crew, a sort of a very strong German and Scottish component, which was very interesting to see that. You know, they're a little bit more relaxed on some of the lifestyle issues that you know, American ships tend to be more Spartan and a little bit more more military-like in terms of their outfitting, but still a lot of fun, and the U.S. ships are really top-notch. But it was interesting to see the different approach that the Schmidt has to running their ships. I only got great things to say. It was a very capable platform and a very capable crew out there.
Well, and Michelle, mm-hmm. you are out there through a brand new Artist at Sea program that they have initiated. I wonder if you get a sense, either your own sense or from Schmidt Ocean Institute, what they feel is the importance not only of your stint at sea, but in general of including artists in oceanographic research cruises.
I'm so glad that Schmidt Ocean Institute sees the important connection that needs to be made between research and the public. And I'm really glad that they see science communication by multiple means, you know, through writing, through video, through art, through outreach, that these are such important components to be able to connect the public to science and to biology and to conservation and to the state of the world. It's a great link that they're making in this instance by developing this program. There are some similar programs like this through other organizations. I'm learning about these things now, and indeed I'm going to be looking into these things to see if I can continue having studios in non-traditional venues like this ship. It's changed my way of looking at where I make my work and how I make my work. And I see it as a fantastic way to bring more information in and then be able to tell more stories.
Mac, there are some scientists who actually, not just on this ship, but in general, will set aside some space in their research cruises for artists. Has having an artist on board while you're doing your research changed your perspective enough that you would find that to be a worthwhile thing in the future to try to bring an artist along when you're out to do one of your research cruises?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, I'm really impressed that Michelle was able to and willing to come and dedicate the time to really, you know, work with us out there and learn about what we were doing. But, you know, I feel like it's underappreciated how creative the scientific process can be. And I think there's a natural synergy between science and art you know, sometimes isn't recognized when we're going through the motions of teaching students sort of the rigor of science. Coupled with that, there can be a lot of creativity in terms of trying to figure out what to study and trying to find a way to let nature speak to us and be able to tell its stories.
While you're out at sea, I mean, as you said, you have this incredible checklist of things you're trying to do, but you do set aside some contemplative time. Are there new questions, you know, as you're out there desperately trying to get what you need to answer the questions you've already come up with? Is that a time when a lot of new questions occur, and what came up during this expedition?
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. I think It's hard to impress on people how young our field is. The four of the most abundant microbes that you see out in the oceans were discovered in the 80s, 90s, and you know, just a few decades ago. And it's like, I think the analog would be for a terrestrial ecologist, you know, you say, hey, I discovered a pine tree this year, right? you know, it's like, really? That, you know, that important a component of the ecosystem was just discovered a few decades ago. So you know, there's a lot of instances out there when we're staring at the data and we're looking at, you know, some of these distributions of where the phytoplankton are and saying, why is that there? And what's controlling that? And how does that live down there where there's, you know, no oxygen and no light? And what is it doing, you know? And then, you know, there's a lot of that because we're, you know, there are scientists together for an extended period of time, you know, eating meals together and living together, you get a chance to really start working through some of your assumptions and some of your thinking.
It's like an intense, prolonged water cooler experience. That's
a great way to put it.
I enjoyed seeing how many times just in casual moments together, you know, both during the cruise and then also the time we had together after the cruise, the science crew members would still keep talking about the issues at hand and still keep bouncing off ideas. And so not only did that offer more time for me to get even broader understanding of what was going on, what they were thinking about, the way they were thinking, but it also let me see the way it's important for these guys to come together, you know, in person. You know, so many of them live in different communities. You know, we had Los Angeles, Maryland, Massachusetts represented, and they don't always get a chance to be in dialogue in person with each other, except at conferences or situations like that. So it was good for me to see them really maximizing their time together. But at the same time, there were also some moments I overheard where they said, okay, we're not going to talk about science for this dinner or something like this, you know. So it was good to see them taking breaks, you know, where you could relax and just be a regular person again instead of always wearing that science hat. But come on, I mean, what you're passionate about is something that infuses all aspects of your life. So that had to happen too.
As someone with a science background and now an artist, you know, Mac talking about how the creativity in science is often underestimated. I've had artists say to me that the discipline in art is often underestimated. Did those parallels between the scientific process and the artistic process really come out in full relief for you while you were out in the ocean?
I loved seeing it from everyone on board. In fact, you know, there were ways in which I had to think about the molecules working together. There were ways that I had to think back to my science training, and there were also ways that the scientists had to think about the design of their experiments or the design of their equipment. We also talked about different equipment that is being designed by engineers on board. You know, these pieces of equipment are sculptures in a way. You know, they're built to be functional, but they're also aesthetically pleasing. They're also aesthetically streamlined or hydrodynamic. You know, there are all these elements that people are working with on a daily basis that have connections to art and creativity. And I think they're often overlooked. I think a lot of people say that, oh, you know, I can't draw a straight line, so therefore I could never be an artist. But there's so much more to it than that. It's in so many ways a way of thinking and the way of seeing the world or seeing your task at hand, not just what you can draw. It's much bigger than that.
Michelle Schwengel-Regala is a fiber artist who recently joined a cruise to the tropical Pacific to understand how life lives in areas with almost no oxygen. Mac Saito was the chief scientist on that cruise. He's an associate scientist with tenure in the Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry Department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Mac and Michelle, thank you to both of you.
Thanks very much.
Mahalo.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Elsa Partan and Heather Goldstone. Jenny Junker answers the phones. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment and by the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.